Welcome, everybody, and happy Black History Month. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Hello, Buzz of the North, WBZH Hayward. I'm going out statewide, big fun, love to hear from everyone from all corners of the state. I think we're going to have a really great show today. So much to talk about. We're going to be joined by candidate for the City of Milwaukee Comptroller's Office. I would argue probably the second most important elected official in the City of Milwaukee. We're going to be joined by candidate Bill Christensen. If you think about it this way, comptrollers are the CFOs of public organizations. And when they are independently elected, boy, do they make a difference. Stewards of the taxpayer dollars, fiduciaries to residents and citizens and taxpayers all alike. Couldn't be more important if you think the CEOs matters. It's always the ones watching the books that may matter just as much, if not a little bit more. So you're not going to want to miss that. Bill joining us at the bottom of the hour. Couple of other programming notes. I'm going to be taking a little bit of a vacation for the remainder of this week. News for everybody, including my good friend working the board and the booth, Anya Esther. So if you want to give us a call, if you're in Hayward, WRJN Racine, the Eagle up in La Crosse, Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley at 93.5, the Tap. Say hello to Anya Esther when you give her a call at 844-967-2789. We're going to be playing some of my best ofs. You're not going to want to miss the rest of the week, but do not fret. Do not worry, everybody. You will hear me back again on these, them, their radio waves of the Civic Media Radio Network. Let's just jump right in because not just in honor of Black History Month, but I think also out of respect for history, many folk listening may not be familiar with the history behind the Black National Anthem, also known as Lift Every Voice and Sing. It was originally a poem written by James Weldon Johnson, who was alive from 1871 to 1938. He was born in Florida. He was a national organizer for the NAACP, wrote a bunch of poetry and nonfiction. He really leaned into and explored racial identity in the United States, as well as in general, the African-American folk tradition here in the United States. I just wanted to share with you a little bit of the lyrics of this song, but originally poem, because they are so poignant and so powerful. We may get a little of the vibe, a little of the tunage today or when I am able to return after my vacation. But here is the poem. Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing us a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun. Let us march on till victory is won. And there's a couple of lines in that opening refrain that maybe some of us are familiar with that I wanted to focus in on today. And that is sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. And what poet James Weldon Johnson brings together there for us to reflect upon during this month of Black history is learning from our past so that we can have hope in our present. And isn't that so powerful in this particular political moment, in this political maelstrom that we're all facing, whether you're Republican or Democratic, independent, undecided, whatever you may be. I think we all, as a group of people, never want to be ignorant of our past, because if we are ignorant of our past, we're always doomed to repeat it. And only by understanding and knowing our past can we, in fact, engage with the hope that is here in the present. And so with all of that in mind, I wanted to share with you what I thought was just a compelling piece that came out of the Washington Post just last week. Published, again, WAPO, written by Hannah Nattinson, published on February 1st. It is a story about a teacher in South Carolina. You may have heard of her last year. Her name's Mary Wood. Last year, in a South Carolina school district, the Lexington Richland School District number 5 in Chapin, South Carolina, she's a high school teacher, and she was teaching AP English, language and composition. And she handed out last year and taught a book by Ta-Nehisi Coates called Between the World and Me. Ta-Nehisi Coates, well-known African-American author. This particular book is his personal memoir, and he really talks about what it means to be Black in America. And after she taught this book last year, a couple of students in her English class complained to the school board, and they alleged that this memoir, Between the World and Me, which does explicitly make an argument that racism is embedded in American society, these students complained that the book made them feel ashamed and guilty for being white. And as a result, there was a huge uproar. Teacher Mary Wood was given a letter of reprimand, and she was forced to stop teaching the book last year. That's the background. What I want to focus on today is the story about how she is now again teaching this book and how she has gone about approaching teaching this book. And what I'd like to ask all of you to engage with me about is, I don't want to debate the premise about whether or not students should be made to feel guilty or ashamed in class, right? I don't want to debate these policies that say you can't say things that make kids feel guilty or ashamed or in any kind of psychological distress, because I think this just takes us down a rabbit hole. I don't think most of us believe in book banning. And I think most of us agree that knowing and understanding history with all of its complexities and disagreements that people have about their own individual perspectives on history, that regardless of all that, we need to know these things. And so the question that I want to ask all of us, and if you're a conservative, you're going to go to the front of the line on you. If we got a conservative that calls in, I want him at the front of the line. If you happen to be conservative, even if you're centrist, whatever it is, and you're challenged by the teaching of these books, the question that I want to ask all of us is this. Let's accept the premise that we need to teach students complicated history. And so my question to all of us, and again, if you're a conservative, please give us a call, 844-967-2789. You can text us as well. You go to the front of the line because I want to hear from you. We agree that we have to engage with these difficult parts of our past, and oftentimes the way that our past impacts our present. How do we do that? How do we do that? If you agree, and let's, again, I just want to accept this as premise, that we have to engage with these difficult parts of our histories, and that understanding that other folks have experienced historical moments differently than we may have, then if we're going to engage with complexities in history, how do we do that if we're not banning the book or books? And what I think is occurring here in Ms. Wood's class and her AP English language and composition class in Chapin, South Carolina, is an exemplar of how we go about doing that. We don't do it by banning books. We don't do it by saying we're never going to talk about these things. We do it by engaging in the most thoughtful way possible to help young people understand and develop their own viewpoint. In other words, I reject indoctrination, whether it's coming from the right or the left. I don't want to tell you what to think. I want teachers and all of us, even here on the show, to be working together about how to think. In other words, how to engage with complicated, difficult subjects. And so let me tell you a little bit more about Chapin, South Carolina, and then I'm going to tell you more about how Ms. Wood is going about teaching this book that nearly got her fired last year. Okay. So here's a little bit about Chapin, South Carolina. The median income is above $100,000. It's mostly very large, beautiful homes that surround Lake Murray. Again, this is in Lexington Richland School District number 5. Most folks in Chapin, South Carolina, they're white. Miss Wood's class this year has got 26 kids in it. 24 of those kids are white. It's a predominantly white school that she teaches at. And most of these kids have never had any exposure to what it might be like to grow up black, in the 80s and 90s, let alone grow up black in a place like Baltimore. And that's what Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, is about. It's about growing up black in Baltimore. So, yeah, if we're talking about race and you're in a very affluent south of the Mason-Dixon school district where there's very few, if any, black folks in your class or in your school, it's going to be difficult. This is going to be challenging subject matter. But yet, I think we're all compelled as Americans to not shy away from that difficult subject matter. We try to do that every day here on the Maggie Dawn Show. If it's thorny, if it's complicated, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it together. 844-967-2789. If you're a conservative, you're going to go right to the front of the line. Let's accept that we got to talk about history. We got to talk about it. And we've got to teach history. We've got to explain how history relates to our present so that, again, in the present, we can be full of hope. And I think hope springs from an understanding of the complexities. As James Weldon Johnson said, the dark past, the complexities, the faith that the understanding, that the unpacking of our dark past has taught us so that we can have hope today. I think that is a human calling. We all seek understanding. And the question becomes not if, rather, but how. That, to me, is the call of the moment, whether we're talking about Miss Wood's AP English Language and Composition class in Chapin, South Carolina, or we're talking about whether or not candidate Nikki Haley can answer a question about why the Civil War was fought. Isn't it all the same question? I want to hear from you. How do we engage these topics with our young people, with each other, and with presidential candidates? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoice. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Welcome back. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Happy Black History Month to Black, White, Purple, Polka-Dotted, Puerto Rican, and Haitian, if I am referencing some old Tribe Called Quest from the mid-90s. Join the conversation, 844-967-2789. I am not going to debate whether or not schools should have policies about whether or not kids can be made to feel guilty or ashamed. We may touch on that, but what I want to ask all of us is, let's assume we've got to talk about the complexities, the difficulties, the moments of American failure in our history so that we can best understand our present, so that we can engage with the implications of that past in our present moment. And I think the example of teacher Mary Wood in Chapin, South Carolina, sets us on a good course to engage that discussion. If you are on the line, stay there, 844-967-2789. If you want to join us, do not wait. Let's get it going on the text and talk lines, 844-967-2789. So here is how teacher Wood, Miss Wood, is approaching teaching Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, a memoir that dissects what it means to be Black in America. She's teaching it to a predominantly white class, 24 of 26 students in her AP English class, white, in a very wealthy, predominantly white suburb that surrounds a beautiful lake in South Carolina. So in a very conservative state. So school policy demands that she receive approval of her curriculum and particular books that she wants to teach. So the first thing that she did was she went to the principal and proposed a curriculum about how to teach Between the World and Me. Interesting side note, there's a new principal at the school, happens to be a Black man. Second, she gave every single parent her curriculum with her specific teaching approach for this book, which was included in that curriculum. She reminded them of that 2 weeks before she was going to teach the text and a week before she began to teach the text. She offered for any family to opt their child out of that book. Again, giving parents choice. She also brought about some conservative thinking and writing that effectively pushed back on the premise of Coates's book. So conservative analysis that basically says systemic racism in the United States does not exist. And she's incorporating that into her teaching of this book. She's going to play a recording of the book, allowing the students to read along and take notes. And then after that, she's going to ask them to conduct independent research to develop their own thinking and arguments. They can agree with Coates, they can disagree with him, or they can land somewhere in the middle. This is literally what she said to her, and this is a quote because I want to get this right. To her students, she said, "Whatever conclusion you arrive at is yours. Arguments are not supposed to be comfortable, but they are also not supposed to be filled with guilt. There is nothing to be ashamed of." By the way, most AP teachers that have looked at this text believe, and it's a Pulitzer Prize finalist, believes that it is really a masterclass in how to deploy and use rhetorical devices, the way that Coates goes about explaining his experience growing up Black in Baltimore. It is really an incredible exercise in rhetoric and rhetorical argumentation. So for that reason, in an AP English and composition class, it's a really great text to show students how to engage and make arguments. It not only teaches them a different perspective, but it can teach them how to write well. Joanne from Madison, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What do you think about this? How do you, I know you're a professor, how do you teach complex topics? What do you think about the teacher's approach?
I was going to go back to to a lower level and be talking about songs. Lift Every Voice and Sing is tremendous, and it would be wonderful to have that in every classroom. But what I was thinking about is the song This Land Is Your Land by Woody Guthrie, and I'm bringing it up for a particular reason, because it's often been branded as a Marxist song, and you can't have something like that. If you read the lyrics, they're powerful. I mean, it really brings us all in. But on the other hand, one of the difficulties, I'm going to be bringing up a difficulty in accepting anything like a new song for the classroom. Some people would think that this is a song that's not in keeping with Native American philosophies because they own this land. They owned it before we came. And there has been protest. And again, let me just characterize the song a little bit. Woody Guthrie, of course, with the banjo, and This Land Is Your Land, It's My Land, from California to the New York Island. And he talks about getting reaffirmed by God in his ownership of this land and our all of our ownership. And then he talks about welfare lines, and he talks about the poverty that shouldn't be there in this great, great, rich country. And when just looking at the song and remembering how I brought it into protests when I would do protests not too long ago, and having people gather around me and sing it because it's so easily sung, that would be great. But everything that we try to do in this area has problems. Again, with Native Americans saying, "Hey, you stole this land from us," you know, which is another song. Maybe I should write that song. We stole this land from you. We regret that we did. But again, just to note that there are other ways. I mean, what you were describing in terms of curriculum and bringing everybody in and notifying parents and having options and all that for students. I mean, it's a master class in how to handle the introduction of a controversial book. But just wanted to bring up the song lyric issues that can develop even with something like a Woody Guthrie classic.
Thanks so much, Joanne. And in the problematic elements of Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land presents the promise of what is engaging discussion. again, there is very little that we will experience as students and as human beings that doesn't have some layer of complexity. And one of the things that I think raises certain elected officials to be true leaders, that raises thinkers, maybe even talkers on the radio, to make them deeply value add for our society as a whole, is not the initial or the R or the D that goes behind their name, but their willingness to hear all sides, but then to dig in and to critically assess those arguments and to think about not just what's problematic, but how to engage with those problematic and complex issues to help us see promise in our present. Lift every voice and sing, indeed. I think this is the moment in America to really be able to engage with one another. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're going to be coming back after these important messages to talk to City of Milwaukee Comptroller candidate Bill Christensen. If you're on the line and you still want to get in on this topic about Ms. Wood and her teaching approach, stay there. We'll get to you. Can't wait to bring Bill in. You're not going to want to miss this, because the CFOs, folks, they matter in the private sector. I'd say they matter even more in the public sector. Keep it locked, folks. Lots more coming up. Everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you've listened at all before, you know I've got mad respect for all those public servants out there doing their jobs, mostly thanklessly, sometimes taking more flack than thanks. And certainly we've got one of those joining us as a guest here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Remember, you can always get the Civic Media app for free from your favorite app store and then listen wherever you are on this rock called Earth, crystal clear every day. You can also join us with one click, 844-967-2789. So much easier from the app, but we are also taking calls and texts the old-fashioned way. Again, that's 844-967-2789. Let me welcome my next guest, a friend of mine, current public servant extraordinaire, and now candidate for the City of Milwaukee Comptroller's Office, Bill Christensen. Welcome, Bill, to the Maggie Dawn Show. So glad to have you this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Maggie, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on here, and I'm thrilled to get the opportunity to spread the message to everybody, and not just in the city of Milwaukee, but across the world listening to it right now.
That's right. So before we took some messages from our wonderful sponsors, I was saying to folks that while it's the, quote, chief executive officer positions that get all of the attention typically electorally, so your county executives, your mayors, your governors, and even, yes, your presidents of the United States, that in local governments, your chief financial officers, your CFOs, also known as comptrollers or controllers, depending on who you're talking to, we could have a whole entire hour devoted to how do you pronounce the word comptroller. I'm going to go with comptroller so people actually know how to spell it. But that position, at least in my humble opinion, it is just as important and yet so unknown to voters and citizens. Can you explain to people what a comptroller is and what they do for a city the size of a place like Milwaukee?
Sure thing. Well, Maggie, I am also a hard P comptroller.
All right. Great minds think alike, my friend. It is a comptroller. Tell everybody what they do.
So the short answer, we protect the city's money. The long answer is we are in charge of accounting, auditing, financial reporting. We process payroll. We issue debt. We are the city's fiscal watchdog. We're also the voice of fiscal responsibility and sound financial management on behalf of city residents. Now, the reason that it's an independently elected position is that we report to directly to the residents of the city of Milwaukee and not to the mayor or to the council, which does give that degree of independence. So we are able to serve as that sort of check and balance against the mayor and the common council.
And why is the independence, why is that check and balance, especially in a local government, so essential? So explain to people, like, actually what it means to not be a political appointee, to have that independence, to go through an electoral process. What does that enable you to do? If you want to use a hypothetical or real example, I think it would really bring it home to folks.
Sure. I think the most real example that I can give that should be pretty relatable is the comptroller is in charge of revenue recognition in each year's budget. So what we do is we independently estimate revenues that we believe will be received by the city in the next year's budget. So the reason that you want to have an independently elected office that's doing revenue recognition is you could have, let's just say a fanciful prediction of we think this revenue is going to bring in $10 million. It's never brought in more than $6 million before. All the data says it's going to be right around six. But in order to close your budget gap, you might have, and I'm not saying this, admit, but you might have a hypothetical administration that says, well, you know what? We think that that revenue is going to come in at $10 million. That's our story, and we're sticking to it.
And then they would budget around that effectively inflated revenue number.
Exactly. Exactly. So then you could find yourself in a situation where you have a shortfall at the end of the year. And then you're faced with some pretty undesirable options of borrowing to cover operating costs or dipping into your fund balance to cover operating costs, neither of which are something that you want to do.
So I'm going to even layperson more friendly that, because when you spend time talking about these things, We folks that deal with these things on the public sector side of it sometimes use the lingo. So if that was a little dense for anybody out there, let me put it really simply. If an administration, meaning an elected chief executive officer like a mayor, a governor, or a county executive, has a pet project that they want to get done, and to get that done, it's going to cost some hugely unreasonable amount of money, they might use some totally unreasonable estimate of how much tax revenue they would get so that they can justify an unreasonable expenditure for a pet project, which if they were allowed to do that without an independently elected chief financial officer like a comptroller, would result in a significant deficit that taxpayers in some way, shape, or form would then be on the hook to fund. Whether they're paying to borrow money, the personal equivalent of that is you put it on a credit card and then you're paying 25% interest. And so because the office that Mr. Christensen is running for is independent, they would be a check on that elected mayor, county executive, or governor to say, no, you're not going to raise $10 million in property taxes. You're only going to get $6 million. So that pet project for $9 million ain't going to happen. And it is that kind of watchdog work that you do currently in the comptroller's office and that you propose to do as the elected comptroller that's so essential for all of us, whether or not you own property, you're paying sales taxes, you're paying some kind of tax if you at all buy a good or service here in the city of Milwaukee. So tell folks what you do right now in the comptroller's office and why you're interested in running for this position, Bill.
Sure. And I'm loving the hard P on that comptroller, man.
Yeah, we got to stick with it.
So I am the deputy comptroller right now. It's a role that I've been in for about a year and a half. So I currently serve under Aicha Sawa, who is the comptroller. She brought me on, and she's been doing an excellent job. And I was sad to learn this fall that she was not going to be seeking re-election this spring. So I started taking a look at the playing field and taking a look at my credentials and my experience. So I'm a 14-year public finance professional, all with the city of Milwaukee. I am a certified public finance officer. I'm a lifelong city of Milwaukee resident. I grew up on the southwest side, the son of an MPS teacher and a Milwaukee firefighter. Currently live on the east side, and I felt like I am the best candidate to continue the kind of current financial trajectory that the city's on. I mean, the city has turned a corner, and I think it's going to take some strong, experienced financial leadership in the comptroller's office to help make sure that we continue on that positive trajectory that we've found ourselves on as a result of some recent changes. I mean, that a lot of it came with Act 12, with a sales tax, with an increase in shared revenue, with a solution to the pension problem we've been facing. So I think I'm well positioned to make sure that the city can continue on its current positive financial trajectory.
One of the things that I was curious to talk with you about, Bill, is that there's this juxtaposition. While we just lauded all of the reasons, we applaud the reasons for having an independently elected comptroller. Having an independently elected comptroller also carries risk because it subjects this critically important role, this critical check and balance that affects everyone's checkbook as a citizen and resident and taxpayer in the city of Milwaukee. This super important role. It's great because it's independent. You're not an appointee of the mayor. You can't be removed at will if the mayor doesn't like it, the way one of his programs is audited or a department is audited. But the fact that it is elected subjects that critically important expert function within the city to a political process. And that bears risk. Because often the way that the political process works is it rewards great big giant personalities and people that are good at shaking the hands and kissing the babies. But we always have to be sure that people in these technical expert roles indeed do have the technical expertise to do the job, to do it independently, and to do it fearlessly. How are you preparing yourself? Because oftentimes it puts you at odds with mayors or other elected officials. How has that experience been for you, given your 14 years at the city so far? Are there examples of the independence of the office that you have stood behind in addition to your technical credentials that sort of speaks to the challenge that this office poses?
Well, I think that's a very good point about you need to sort of transform yourself into a politician in order to get into one of these roles. Now, I've very much been throughout my career a kind of back office public finance guy. I was in the city's budget office for about 12, 13 years, and now deputy comptroller for a year and a half. And I haven't been too much in the limelight, and now I'm forcing myself to get out there. And I'm doing the shaking hands. I haven't kissed a baby yet, but I know that. That comes in at some point in the race, but I think the independence of the office is very important, and there's pros and cons that come with having an independently elected office. You're right; you could have somebody that gets in it for the wrong reasons, who has political motivations, who might not have the credentials, but is good at getting elected. But I think the pros outweigh the cons, and that's why it's one of the reasons that I'm running is to make sure that we've got somebody. And I'm not a guy that likes to toot my own horn, but in this case, I will. I've got the credentials, I've got the experience, and making sure that the city's finances, at least in terms of what the comptroller does, are in good hands.
Let me ask you a question. Forget that it's you running, Bill. If you were to give advice to voters and citizens when they're looking at elections for these technical roles, so the county's comptroller is up for election this year, the city's comptroller is, the city attorney is up. These are technical roles that people often don't have a great handle on. Speaking just about the comptroller's office, what are the sorts of things that you would, if you were just a voter and not a candidate, be looking at? In other words, what is your advice to voters to help them make the most informed decision possible?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think if a candidate knocks on your door and is saying that they're running for one of these offices, I would ask them questions that are as technical in nature as you are able to ask, because it really comes out in a 30-second soundbite. Somebody can sound pretty knowledgeable. In a 5-minute conversation, I think that's where the wheels start to fall off if they don't actually have the technical know-how, the experience. And I know that that's kind of hard to do in a citywide race like this. It's hard to knock on everybody's door. So as much as I will try to get around to everybody's door, it's probably not going to happen. But I think the things you want to look for, you want to look for a steady hand. You want to look for somebody who is who bases what they say they're going to do in reality. I mean, a little bit of homework on what the position does, and you'll know what the comptroller can and cannot do. If they say that they're going to spend more money on potholes and fix your streetlights, I mean, that's not what the comptroller does. That's not the role that they serve. The mayor and the common council set the budgets. So
I'm going to jump in here. Sorry to interrupt, Bill. You can find out more about Bill and what the comptroller does at Bill for Milwaukee. And that is Bill for MKE. So Bill for Milwaukee, Bill for MKE.com. Bill, I'd love to have you back again in just a little bit of time. We have under a minute left. I'm going to give you the last word as we go into break. Everybody, you're going to want to keep it locked. I'm going to revisit this conversation about how we engage with difficult topics when we come back. But Bill, what's your 30-second pitch to voters out there? Why Bill Christensen?
Why Bill Christensen? Well, I'm the only candidate in the race that's got municipal finance experience. We're going through a number of challenges. We've got a number of opportunities on the horizon as well. I think it's going to be important to have a steady hand as the city's next comptroller. I plan on taking steps to improve the city's bond rating. So that's less money spent on interest to bankers and investors and more money for core city services. I want to build on transparency initiatives that are already in place. And
we're going to have to leave it there. Bill, thanks so much. I will have you back because I think this is just as important as the CEO. It's the CFO keeping an independent eye on the city's books. Thanks, Bill. I'm Maggie Dawn. We'll be back with more after these important messages here on The Maggie Dawn Show.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
Got to unmute that microphone, my dear.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. My biggest thanks to my friend and City of Milwaukee Comptroller candidate, Bill Christensen. I try to ask candidate guests to get, you know, underneath the thing that it is that they're running for, to really dig in to the meat and potatoes of what that elected official's role is and why it matters to all of us. And Tom from New Berlin on our text line saying, what a great guest like Bill to have. It's a relief that Bill is in civil service. I agree. Thank you, Bill. These are the sorts of roles that can make or break local governments. Again, not always the sexiest stuff, not always the easiest to understand. But having a truly independent chief financial officer, a truly independent financial watchdog for your local government makes all the difference. Because if it wasn't independently elected or you get somebody who's incompetent in there, chaos can ensue. Bad things can happen for residents and taxpayers. So while it may not be the sexy stuff, this is the thing that will impact everyone's life. And for all those folks up in the northern part of the state, given that Milwaukee is the economic engine of the state, and that as goes Milwaukee, so goes the rest of the state, that election, that comptroller's election might be the last thing on your radar, but I swear it matters to you too. And the connective tissue here between Miss Mary Wood and her AP English language and composition class in Chapin, South Carolina, and a candidate like Bill Christensen is this. Public service done right takes courage and it takes tenacity. It takes someone who is willing to put the service element in what is good for people ahead of their own self-interest. Nobody does these jobs for the most part because they're hugely sexy or because somebody's going to call you up and say thanks. You do them because you have a call to serve people and to do the right thing. And when we return to what I talked about for the first portion of my show today, which you never want to miss because I always tie it all together, Miss Wood teaching AP English, despite the fact that she was reprimanded last year and told not to teach Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, she's teaching it again. And she's doing that because she knows that it's right to help students engage with complexity, to help us all engage with complexity, despite the fact that this woman may very well lose her job. I nearly guarantee that complaints will be made, despite all of these steps that she's undertaken to help engage and encourage the students to challenge themselves to think deeply, to think differently, and to think better. Not to tell them what to think, but how to think. We're going to go to the phone lines. If you want to get in on this discussion, 844-967-2789. How do we treat public servants that tell the truth? How do we encourage public servants to tell the truth? How do we encourage one another to deal with the difficulties of our past so that we can engage with the hope of the present? One of my favorite people and yours, Mark from Prairie du Sac, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you, my friend?
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call. That would, you know, thinking things through, you know, listening on the conversation, thinking what I was going to say, that it's amazing to me that people that they get upset about these kids feeling guilty about what's went on in this country, you know, say via slavery and via the prejudices, going, might not have any problem with everybody when they go to church on Sunday being told by the minister you're supposed to feel guilty about what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. But of course, the burden of original sin falling especially heavily upon the women, that because you're forever marked by that stain because you originally, you know, mythologically accepted, you know, that, you know, what Satan said as in his form as a snake. So I find, and maybe that's not a good example, but I mean that we've struggled with trying to edit our history and edit what was going on well into the foundation of this country, because I know prior to the Civil War, abolitionist literature was banned in the South, in the states that held slaves. You know, in fashion, you know, mutiny of slaves was a crime in some states. I mean, the fact that they don't want people to teach that history. I mean, at the Constitutional Convention, I mean, people were arguing about how bad slavery was. I mean, they were arguing about the irony of pointing out the fact that all men are created equal, except when you go to the Constitution, you actually could institute slavery by saying persons, rather than when the Confederacy was formulated its Constitution, actually probably being more honest and just saying slaves. That we have to teach that history in order to understand where we are at today, because there are people of color that still do not have full voting rights in this country.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the call as ever and always. There's so much promise and potential and looming danger in the present moment. And I think our willingness to engage in the complicated conversation here on this network and with one another, you know, on bar stools at our local tavern, in our churches, at our dinner tables, these are the moments that can make a difference. My objective on this show is to engage with you, to help us all understand, to deal with the difficult information, our difficult past, so that we can again engage as neighbors, as fellow citizens, to make sense of our present moment. I just want to share a brief line from Between the World and Me. The book begins with this. Son, last Sunday, the host of a popular news show asked me what it meant to lose my body. The American dream is a perfect dream with perfect houses and nice lawns. It is Memorial Day cookouts, block associations and driveways, tree houses, and the Cub Scouts. For so long, I have wanted to escape into the dream, to fold my country over my head like a blanket. But this has never been an option for me because the dream rests on our backs, the bedding made from our bodies. It's time to